I do want to thank Aiden Connors. I was walking in the church and realized that I had forgotten to get a liturgist. We found out Friday the person who was signed up was not able to do it. And I said, oh no, we don't have a liturgist. And she said, I'll do it. So thank you. Listen now to the second reading, which comes to us from the Gospel according to Luke, the 12th chapter, verses 13 through 21. Someone in the crowd said to Jesus, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me." But he said to him, "Friend, who set me to be a judge or arbiter over you?" And he said to them, "Take care. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. For one's life does not consist in the abundance of possessions." Then he told them a parable. The land of a rich man produced abundantly, and he thought to himself, "What should I do, for I have no place to store my crops?" Then he said, "I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, 'Soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry.'" But God said to him, "You fool, this very night your life is being demanded of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be?" So it is with those who store up treasures for themselves but are not rich toward God. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. Please pray with me. O God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be acceptable to you, O God, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. If you step off one of the restricted elevators onto the executive suite level of Under Armour, you are greeted by a young person, mid-20s, I'd guess. Behind her reception desk, below the giant Under Armour logo, are three words written in proprietary font. Powerful, young, aggressive. Under Armour, like most successful organizations, pays a great deal of attention to their culture. It is what they use to direct and advance their mission. It's what they use to attract top talent. It's what they spend their resources on. Though I doubt they'd say it this way, their clothing is not really what they are selling. It is their culture. Peter Drucker coined the phrase, "culture eats strategy for breakfast," as a way of pointing to the fact that many leaders of organizations of all kind spend way too much time on strategy when the culture of an organization is where the energy for action is centered. Visiting Under Armour recently, it occurred to me that if you asked many people in America today for three words to describe the church, especially if you ask young people, they might just come up with the three words that are the opposite of the ones posted on the wall of Under Armour: weak, old, timid. Those are certainly words that I felt about the church in my college years. Reading at that time political theorists and democratic socialists and social movement historians, I began to see everything that was wrong with the tradition that had shaped me. the obsession with prudish, individualistic values cloaked in biblical authority, the neglect of the poor, the aversion to risk, the ignoring of conversations about social issues that were affecting the lives of the people around me. I was ready to engage the world, whereas the church culture that I was most familiar with seemed ready to stick its head in the sand and pretend that its doctrines or its tired hymns or its formalities were interesting to a kid like me. So you can imagine my surprise to find myself as a primary cheerleader this year for a capital fund appeal that seems to dredge up all the things that pushed me to reject the church a couple of decades ago. Actually, what's surprising is my delight to find myself as one of the designated cheerleaders for the season of fundraising that we've entered. And so today I want to offer some thoughts for your consideration as you pray and consider what gift you will bring on or before June 19th. And if you are visiting today, fear not, this sermon may just have something to say to you too. First, and this may be shocking for some of you, I am not very attached to any of our buildings. When Doug Adams asked the question at one of our congregational discussions about this appeal, have we considered tearing down all of our buildings and rebuilding everything from scratch? I think I was probably one of the few people with oxygen left to respond, mainly because I had wondered similar things. If not tear them down, why not sell them and move to a location much cheaper to maintain with more modern facilities that meet our modern needs, including accessibility, a parking lot, etc.? As a Christian now for more than four decades, I have worshiped in theaters, under tents, in people's homes, and on the street in the rain. Buildings are not essential to following Jesus. In fact, too many congregations today, it seems, are weighed down by expensive buildings that they do not have adequate resources to maintain. Now, you should take this with a grain of salt, knowing that your pastor, newly married, tried to get his spouse to make our first home together in a North Carolina trailer park because it was the cheapest option at the time. The question I ask myself about our buildings are these. Do we have a specific calling in this place? And if so, how do our facilities support that calling? Asked another way, if we picked up and left this corner tomorrow, would it make a difference to anyone in Bolton Hill, in this wider part of town, or to the city? I don't know if that kind of a question can ever be answered definitively, but I do know this. It mattered to the teachers at John Eager Howard who watched one of the tutors in our tutoring program work through a challenging incident with her tutee recently. She said to me, "Andrew, you can't imagine how much grace that tutor showed in a very difficult situation. I am so grateful your church is here." It mattered to the young man who walked quietly under the rainbow flag every week for a year while a student here in Baltimore and wrote me a note to say that this welcoming church had literally saved his life. It mattered to Congressman Cummings who walked into the sanctuary for the Tiffany series not too long ago, saw a predominantly white crowd that day who had come to hear him reflect on One Baltimore and whispered to me, "Is this a friendly crowd?" "I don't understand," I said. "You mean because of all the white people?" "Yes," he said. "You see, I've never been invited to speak to a predominantly white crowd before." It mattered to our brothers and sisters in West Baltimore, who we hosted for 7 weeks around a shared table set by Jesus. It mattered to Mount Royal Improvement School in our neighborhood, whose principal called me not too long ago wondering how in the world they were going to preserve their most important student formation experience that had been cut with their budget. Not only did we make the first commitment, we hosted the event that raised more than what they needed. It mattered to the spouse whose loved one took his own life and knew us through our public witness. Of course, I would lead the service, I told him. That's who our church is. I could go on and on through the last month or through the last century about what it means for this church to be on this corner. Our buildings are not important because of what they are. They are important because of who we are and because of how we use them to tutor children, to raise our children in the faith, to break bread at dangerous tables that cross ancient divides, to organize and prepare meals to feed the hungry, to educate us on the most pressing concerns of our time and what the church must do about them, forming disciples who disperse to the world to work for justice and struggle for peace. And like every missional outpost, buildings require upkeep. Many of you know last summer we had a team of volunteers look at our actual current use of our spaces, our projected use, and dreams and possibilities for future use. They helped the session and the trustees prioritize repairing our two towers and overhauling this education wing so that we can reshape some of our spaces to fit our needs, instead of always reshaping our needs to fit into our spaces. A key part of that reshaping includes an elevator, which is expensive. I look at it this way. We have been here for nearly 150 years. Are we reasonably committed to being here for another 50 to 75? If the answer to that question is yes, then when we have the opportunity and the resources, our spaces need to reflect our needs as well as our values. We know that our lack of accessibility has caused tutors who can't make it to the third floor to drop out of our program. It has been a barrier to current church participants who can't get to spaces on the second and third floor. And if we are a church that is committed to reducing, if not eliminating, barriers to everyone's participation, barriers of every kind, then an elevator is an essential part of that mission. It's part of the culture that we create. Secondly, I am excited about this appeal because it gives us all a chance to express our gratitude to God in a very concrete way. Now, I know that talking about money in church is a dicey topic, ripe with the potential for manipulation. But more than half of Jesus' parables have to do with money and possessions. The Bible itself has over 2,000 verses on the topic of money and possessions compared to, say, 500 on prayer and 500 on the topic of faith. Jesus warns his disciples again and again that money is a red herring. It can so easily distract us from what is important, which is living generously. It is so often the focus of our anxiety, which Niebuhr believed was the fertile ground that always led to our sin. I've seen it hold rich and poor alike captive to the fear that there will not be enough. And on the flip side, I've observed wealthy individuals give money away freely, and a hungry homeless man share half his dumpster pizza with another sister in need. The church is the place where we have the chance to cultivate our generosity. becoming more generous human beings, learning to share by recognizing that our lives are not our own, and neither are the gifts of this earth. In Jesus' parable from Luke's gospel, the rich man uses wealth to hedge against his anxiety. In a very prudent and wise way that I'm sure the financial managers among us will commend, he puts everything that he'll need and more away for a rainy day. But notice his speech. He thought to himself, I should do this. I have nowhere to store my crops. I will do this. I will do that. I will say to my soul, the conversation is all about me, myself, and I. And then death comes and he finds himself not secure, but alone. Most days when I enter the church office over here, I walk past the wall, some of you have seen it, that has the photographs of all the pastors' faces hanging on it. Except for the most recent pastors, I can probably give you only one sentence about each one. It makes me wonder sometimes, what's the one sentence future church folk will say about me? What's the one sentence people will share about you? He died rich and unhappy. She worried her entire life that there would not be enough. Or how about what a generous soul she was in her family, her church, her community? He didn't have much, but he was always sharing what he had. Finally, I'm excited about this appeal because it gives us a chance to work together and trust each other with our gifts. When I counsel couples that are getting married, some are surprised that I end up digging quite deep into conversations about their relationship with money. Do you have a plan for how much you're going to spend each month? Will you do joint checking or keep it separate? Do you think your partner spends more or less than you? Do you have a plan? I am sure that some couples wonder if they've accidentally gone to a financial planner instead of a pastor. But here's what I know. Most couples fight about money more than anything else. More than sex, more than chores, more than in-laws, more than anything. And that is because money is about agency, it's about power, and it's about control. Its reality in our lives tests the church's words that we are a family of faith, that we care for one another, that we abide with each other in love. The widow in Mark's gospel gives everything she has to the temple treasury. The conventional reading of the text is that she is to be commended for her generosity. But in the verses just prior to this story, Jesus also condemns the scribes for devouring widows' houses. The powerful will have to answer for any system that abuses the generosity of others, especially those who are most vulnerable in our midst. The 15 people that you elected to serve on our session have wrestled over questions of priorities and endowment spending and capital needs. So have the 9 saints that you elected to serve as trustees. A facilities planning team has added their expertise and recommendations. The stewardship committee did the same thing. And before that, a task force that said several years ago, yes, we think we're headed for a capital fund appeal, but we're not quite ready yet. We've listened to each other in surveys and congregational discussions and annual meetings. I am quite sure that our particular congregation has gone through a thorough process. I am also quite sure that our particular congregation will never agree unanimously on anything. Ultimately, the gifts that we bring to our church community have to be that. Gifts. A pure gift is one that you give because you love the person or the people or the God that you are giving it to, not because you expect anything in return. It is a matter of trust. Which is exciting to me because the church's handling of money is unlike any other institution that I know. I mean, is there anywhere else where you are invited to show up unannounced, no strings attached, participate fully in this community event, and then are asked to give whatever God might be leading you to give? I mean, is that not the dumbest business plan you have ever heard of in your life? Or maybe it is a different realm of being where trust in God's provision supersedes the consumer culture that we're taught makes the world go round, where gratitude is the only real response that any human being can make when she realizes that she did nothing to receive life and could do nothing, could give nothing to equal its value. There is a long-running debate in our congregation about spending money on mission versus spending money on ourselves. If truth be told, the fact that we constantly have that debate is one of the many reasons why I love our church. But the era of mission, understood only as what a privileged church does for people with little money outside of its doors, is over. For one thing, people with little money are already inside of our doors. We are church together. And for another, Jesus thought the church needed to learn from and with the poor, not treat them as problems that always need to be fixed. The church is not primarily a grant-making institution. No, our mission is to make disciples. People who look at other human beings and think first, there goes a child of God instead of an object to be acted on. People who are ready to cross those ancient divides because they know that their salvation is caught up in the healing of another. People are struggling with how to receive forgiveness or share it with others. People who are hoping to raise children to be more than just productive workers or wealthy hedonists or cautious people whose main goal is to avoid pain at all costs. People who seek justice for all God's children alongside the poor. What we do in this place, the worshiping, the educating, the spiritual formation, the organizing, the hospitality, the plotting and planning, that is a part of God's mission. I couldn't see that in college, so someone else saw it for me. A chaplain who took me to breakfast and asked me questions like, why do you care so much about your own racism? Other white people your age don't seem to care as much. Why do you get so angry at the denigration of women on our campus? Other people seem to be enjoying it. Why are you spending your weekends traveling to distressed communities? Don't you know that's not normal? I couldn't bring my arrogant adolescent self to admit what he saw. That Jesus was at the root of my system. He was the ground of my being, all because a church had built a culture around his name. A culture that had shaped me. The church had imprinted phrases on my insides alongside that crucifix logo that said things like seek justice, love mercy, walk humbly. However hard the market strategized to condition me to treat everyone as a customer, or the nation strategized to teach me that American was the most important spiritual adjective, or the movies strategized to get me to see justice at the end of the barrel of a gun. No, Jesus' culture was stronger. It was stronger because some saints at some time gave their time, their energy, and their resources to a church. This fragile culture built around a foolish business plan, anchored on a foundational belief that this life, actually this moment, is gift, every breath of it, given by a God whose love is pure gift.